There will be spoilers ahead. Lots of spoilers, so be careful, won't you?
Good subjects of Max Mike Movies, welcome! This is a great day for our series Didn't Win, Didn't Win, Didn't Win. And an ironic one, for today we have all won. With this final series entry, Charlie Chaplin's The Great Dictator, we sweep away the dust and cobwebs of the old regime with the broom of freedom and paint a new future with the brushes of justice and the assorted pigments of greatness. And our canvas is your shining faces. Soon to be covered in the mural of peace and smeared with the glory of freedomity. No longer will you toil beneath the iron hoof of your oppressor. Never again! The equine evil has been defeated, and now you will rest gently beneath the carefully padded crocs of your new national parents, Max and Mike. Victory! Peace! Freedom peace! Prospera victory! And freedom pucks for all! Okay, what do you think? Am I ready for the Republican National Convention?
I think you're ready for something.
Yeah,
it's
round and
made of metal and has a lid.
Well, just in case I need more practice, I am Max, twirling towards freedom, Levine, and over there is Mike, dictator, loose. Inspire the masses for us, Mike.
Sadly, quite honestly, probably something I would say.
What is that, the Animaniacs line? Yeah, can we call you Dick or Mr. Tater?
I prefer neither.
But before we get to the glories of our new regime, we have our poll question.
Oh, yeah.
Poll question.
We asked you last time, do you like to know the stories behind the making of your favorite films, or does that ruin the magic?
Magic.
Angelo Patsalas tells us, it's a plus to know what was going on at the time and what viewpoints people had given to help during the process. Okay.
Neat.
Chrissy Becker-Krenitsky says, love it. Cool. It can bring a lot of depth to the film when you know what went into making it, whether it's a behind-the-scenes look at how they did things or knowing the drama that went on behind the scenes.
Drama.
Regan McStravick says, I'm going to once again not quite answer your question. Well, it's the spanking machine for you, Regan.
Good luck.
Yeah. After working on a few dozen films, some of which were even mainstream-ish. Mainstream-ish, really? And adjacent. Countless short films, I find that I watch films differently now than I did 20 years ago. I appreciate good shot setups and am distracted by bad choices. Sometimes I can watch a pretty bad film and find things to like about it. Other times I watch a film that everyone loves and come away thinking, that really wasn't very well crafted. So being familiar with the process, whether in general or specific to the creation of a certain film, changes the way, for me at least, that I experience the film. Sometimes in a good way, sometimes not. Well, you're right, you didn't answer the question, so extra bumpy pucks for you.
What a prize.
Get the feeding funnel.
And the catch net.
Yep.
Otherwise known as the equine diaper. Wee. We keep your pucks fresh.
So you don't have to. Tyler Stewart says, I love hearing the stories, especially how they had to innovate or cleverly work around a problem. Example, the horses in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Our resident scholar, Adam Mark, gives us this treatise. Quote, goodness, what beautiful diamonds. Goodness had nothing to do with it, dearie. Mae West. My Mae West impression is flawless.
That's exactly who I thought it was. Yeah.
I love the story of the making of. The drama and the errors and the firings and the reshoots and the what might have beens. Eric Stoltz's firing to make way for Michael J. Fox in Back to the Future. Oh, boy. That would have been a different movie. Judy Garland's original curly blonde wig in The Wizard of Oz. We talked about that. See our entire episode on The Wizard of Oz.
Yarp.
Marlon Brandon's, I assume he means Brando's, unplanned moment with Kim Novak's glove in The Waterfront. Jennifer Grey's outtake giggles becoming one of the most memorable scenes from Dirty Dancing. Robert Altman's disinterest in following a script, that so much so that the talent had to remind him that this or that scene needed to cover basic plot points. How Mae West was given a bit part in her first film, Night After Night, and ended up stealing the entire film through her sheer force of personality and her ad-libbing lines on set that were so good, no one could say anything other than bravo.
Or bravo.
These histories... pedantic or nitpicky? These histories make the films all the more special. I want to know about the passion and creativity behind it and the meandering path the film navigated. The creative process is inherently interesting in my view, along with the somehow, someway, can-do ability cinematographers must have to break through in order to create amazing and enduring cinema. Barriers of creative-type personalities, budget restrictions, the old studio system and the current blockbuster system, product placement, producer notes, censorship, government and self, self-destructive stars, and on and on and on. Please, let's pay attention to the man behind the curtain who has just stolen your shoes. Wow. Okay.
Wow.
A strong opinion there. Very nicely put.
So in other words, yes.
Yeah. all that was yes? Yes.
More intense.
Val Coons, who some may remember from the mists of time as the creator of the second greatest podcast in the known existence, says, I'm not sure I understand the question. Do you mean like how the entire set of Waterworld was destroyed in a hurricane, or that a certain actor always stood on apple boxes to make him seem taller next to his leading lady? I'm looking at you, Tom Cruise. how a certain scene was done with mocap, motion capture, the actor, yes. Or do you mean how an idea or a book went from concept to shooting script? Oh, okay. I didn't think about those distinctions.
Yeah, why would there
like
be?
Like Regan, I've been on a few shoots, so the magic of how a film or TV show is made has pretty much been ruined for me. I do tend to watch a lot of things and think, oh, I know how that was done, or these actors do not like each other at all. I miss being able to just watch something for the enjoyment. On the other hand, I love to learn some of the trivia after I've seen something, especially the classics. The trivia segment in your show is one of my favorite parts. Why? Oh. Thank you.
And we do exhaustive research in many,
exhaustive.
Many... No, we don't. We cheat.
We use the internet. Roland Hardy says, yes, I do enjoy knowing more about the making of. Concise, to the point. Yeah. Nicely done, Roland.
I wonder how he wrote that. We should ask him.
Jessica Miller says, I want all of the ham. I'm sorry, no, it's all of the info. All of the info. From Dave. I sometimes find the backstory interesting, but mostly I think a work of art should stand on its own without any understanding of the subjective intent of the creator. Okay, that's a very...
He's a deconstructionist, isn't he?
Yeah. Reader response guy. Mm. After I've seen the work and formed an opinion, the backstory details can be interesting, especially if I think the work was brilliant, but such things are not essential to me, and I usually think it a waste of time to dig into that. Huh. Usually, though, I am more interested in why a work appeals to the public in a particular time than in what the movie makers thought they were trying to do. So
kind of a no?
Well, kind of a no in general, but yes in like terms of historical context. It's more of a less of how this was made and more of what was it doing at the time.
And why did people like it then when they don't like it now, et cetera, et cetera.
That's intriguing. And of course, from the snowy wastes in the far northlands where they have yet to discover fire or traffic accidents, we have Vince. Telling us, I like to know the technical stuff and have no interest in behind-the-scenes drama, usually. As a kid, I was fascinated by special effects and editing, two things I've done for work now and then. I had a paperback book called Movie Magic,
about special effects from the Silence, I think until the 70s. It disappeared, but I found the hardcover for next to nothing, and it's still fascinating to me. I have pissed off a few people when I see a great practical effect and point out about who thought it was real and did not want the illusion shattered. For me, the knowledge adds rather than subtracts, but I get that not everybody feels that way.
Yeah. Hey, look at that shoe! Wait, what?
Hey, is that R2-D2 in the Close Encounters ship?
Yeah. Yes, as a matter of fact, it is.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Vince. Thank you, all of you. These are really cool. But what about you, Mike? Do you like... I think I know the answer to this, but do you like to know the behind-the-scenes stuff?
Well, here's the thing. I've always been interested in special effects. I, too, had CineFantastic magazines and CineFX magazines, Starlog special effects issue. I've always been interested in that stuff. I can also totally understand why knowing how the trick is done can ruin some of the wonder, right? Because that's what wonder is about. Wonder is partially not knowing what you're seeing. And
I wonder how they did that.
I wonder why they did that is usually my question. So I, on a lot of cases I do, it's kind of too late. One of the things is when I was a kid, I actually did take lessons to be a magician. No, I wasn't very good, but I now that I'm on that side of things, I kind of can't not look for stuff and can't wonder. Occasionally, though, I'm surprised. Like when I found out, oh yeah, we use CG for the face shields of the helmets in The Martian. I was like, wait, what? That wasn't glass? No, there's nothing there. What? That's brilliant. Because like you don't have to worry about the actor being able to breathe or being muffled or fogging up the helmet. Like that's something like that. When people are really smart, especially when people have like nothing and they still manage to fool you or to come up with something really cool, I really do. It does help me appreciate more. When I get to hear how so-and-so is a total jackass or they were just horrible to work with, you know, that does take things away. But also part of me just like, I don't want them to get away with it. So I guess I'm going to lean towards yes. How about you, though?
I enjoy seeing them, but sort of like Dave says, I like to see it after I've seen the movie, after it's sunk in, after I've, you know, formed my own opinions. I really don't like the stuff where they're showing you making of before the movie's out.
Yeah, this, you start looking for the thing, whatever it is.
Yeah, I don't need that. I do enjoy it. I like to know the behind, like, I like to know how they did stuff. Sometimes I like the drama, or I like to find out that one of the actors did something really nice, like Viggo Mortensen bought his horse for the trainer and gave it to her in Lord of the Rings.
I mean, Viggo Mortensen just sounds like he's the nicest guy ever next to Keanu Reeves, who's constantly giving things to people.
I like finding stuff like that, and I don't really like finding out, well, this person used to set fire to his fellow castmates or whatever.
Ha ha, or feed them X-Lax and handcuff them to the stage or something. I think it was Alfred Hitchcock did that.
He did that once to a cameraman, yes.
The camera, and they said, great, that's special.
Yeah, he was a delight.
Might be talking about him today.
We've got some terrific answers, and we want yet more, for our hunger is unsatiable. Insatiable. Unsatiable. We're hungry!
Read the question!
No! I mean... I'm just curious. We've been talking about movies that didn't win the Oscar. How many of you out there actually still watch the Oscars? Or any of the awards shows, the Golden Globes? If you don't watch the Oscars, is there one you do watch? I am genuinely curious. I know the answer Globes. For Mike and me. That is the Golden Globes.
The BAFTAs?
The SAG Awards or the BAFTAs. I just like to know, does anybody watch any of those and why?
And we'll question tell you I the ask myself every year.
And we'll tell you how to answer that in case you don't already know at the end of the show. But now, things about the movie. The facts. The budget for this movie, this is 1940. $2.2 million.
Really?
And it made $5
million. So...
That is a...
Well, I mean, if you're looking at percentage, that's a success, but it's not a roaring success.
This was Chaplin's most successful financially successful movie ever.
Oh.
Of all of them.
That's very surprising. Times.
Yeah. This was nominated for 5 Oscars.
5.
Didn't win. Yep. Not one. Not a sausage. This movie was released 11 years after the end of the silent era, and this was Sir Charles Chaplin's first all-talking, all-sound film.
So now, wait a sec. When do you consider the end of the silent era? Because the beginning of the sound era is 27, so that'd be 13 years.
Yeah, but I think the last of the silent films was released in 29. I can't remember which one it was. Chaplin got the idea for this when a friend of his named Alexander Korda noted that his screen persona, you know, the little tramp, and Adolf Hitler look kind of similar. Chaplin later learned they were born within a week of each other.
Yeah.
And were roughly the same height and weight, and both struggled in poverty until they reached their great success in their respective fields. Note, Hitler's respective field was not painting.
Oh, actually, he wasn't bad. He just wasn't outstanding. Yeah, I've seen some of his paintings. They're all right.
When Chaplin learned of Hitler's policies of racial oppression and nationalist aggression, he used their similarities as an inspiration to attack Hitler on film. Mm. Hitler banned the film in Germany, big surprise, and in all countries occupied by the Nazis. Allegedly, though, curiosity got the best of him, and he had a print brought in through Portugal. History records that he saw it, he watched it twice, in private, but officially no one knows what his reaction was. Charles Chaplin said, "I'd give anything to know what he thought of it."
Hmm.
According to one biography of Eva Braun, I looked this up.
Braun.
She said he laughed out loud watching it.
I'm trying to picture what that would sound like. What would Adolf Hitler's laughing sound like?
Ha! 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 That's as close as I can get.
Sure.
Prove me wrong. I can't guess this. I've never heard of a recording of him laughing.
Well, Eva Braun's dead, so, you know, can't ask her.
And now, Chaplin, again, according to a bunch of the documentaries, allegedly, he started feeling more and more uncomfortable making fun of Hitler the more he heard of Hitler's actions in Europe. It was ultimately the invasion of France that Chaplin changed the ending of the film. And we'll get to that. This is not the original. That whole speech, which is legendary, where he's basically a cry for peace, that wasn't the way the film was supposed to end.
Wow, what a surprise.
Yeah. By the way, nobody wanted to finance this film. He did it in all. Chaplin did it himself entirely.
Mm.
Chaplin said that wearing Hinkle, you know, the adenoid Hinkle, wearing his costume made him feel more aggressive, and those who were close to him at the time remember him being a lot harder to work with on days that he was shooting as that character.
Hi, Marlon Hinkle, being of sound mind and body.
Pay those nice boys from Video Aces.
Yeah, that's a deeper.
Some of Chaplin's associates tried to talk him out of that final speech about peace. One film salesman said the speech would cost him $1 million at the box office, and Chaplin replied, "Well, I don't care if it's $5 million." The film was banned in Spain until the death of dictator Generalissimo Francisco Franco in 1975. This is just in. He is, in fact, still dead. Apparently, the rumor got around. The studios were trying to discourage Charlie Chaplin from making the film. President Franklin D. Roosevelt sent a representative, a guy named Harry Hopkins, to Chaplin and said, "Please make this movie."
Hmm. Neat. I have a little trivia about that connected to that later, if you don't
mind. Okay. The German spoken by Hinkle is, as anyone who listens can tell, complete nonsense. A couple of words are thrown in. He uses a lot of, you know, Wiener Schnitzel and so forth.
I say a lot of it's food.
Yes, a lot of it is food. The language in which the shop signs and the posters in the so-called Jewish quarter are written in is Esperanto.
Really? Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I only know 2 times that Esperanto showed up in a film, and one of them had William Shatner in it.
Douglas Fairbanks visited the set of the film in 1939 and laughed almost uncontrollably at the scene that was being played. He waved goodbye to Chaplin and left. He was dead within a week. It was the last time Chaplin saw him.
So this film is evil. Evil incarnate.
Chaplin blinks fewer than 10 times during the entire final speech, which lasts over 5 minutes.
Huh.
Production on this film started in 1937. And keep in mind, not in 1937, a lot of people in this country didn't really see the Nazis were a menace or all that bad, even in 1940. This is not, however, the first anti-Nazi satire. It was beaten to the punch by 9 months by the Three Stooges, you nasty spy. Yeah.
Whoop, 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 whoop.
Yes.
Look yuck, at the grouse.
Yuck. Yuck. Mo, Larry, the cheese.
The Mo, original Larry, Curly.
Yes, that's James Mason as Mo Howard. Lawrence, Curly. The original ending was supposed to be shots of people all over the world accepting the message of peace as goose-stepping German soldiers broke into a waltz and Japanese bombers dropped toys on Chinese children, probably killing them, considering how high they were. He actually started shooting some of these scenes before abandoning the idea. Allegedly, They Still Survive is part of these home movies shot by his son, so you can find them somewhere.
His son, Mo Chaplin.
Yeah, that's right. General Dwight D. Eisenhower personally requested French-dubbed versions of this film from Chaplin for distribution in France after the Allied victory there.
How odd.
Yeah, at the time, at the premiere, Chaplin was a little worried about his gamble on this because the Gallup polls revealed 96% of Americans opposed U.S. involvement in the war in Europe. And there were a ton of threatening letters coming in from Nazi sympathizers pouring into the studio. At one point, he even asked a friend with the Longshoremen's Union in New York if they could have some union members present at the opening in case any pro-Nazis showed up. Hinkle's stormtroopers are wearing World War I-era Imperial German spiked helmet, which are in fact called Hickelhauben, with the top spikes removed. They're also wearing them backwards.
Of course.
The actor Jack Oak, or Oakey, excuse me, once said that he had, quote, made hundreds of pictures, but they only remember me as Napoloni in The Great Dictator. This was the last movie that Chaplin used the little tramp outfit, the bowler hat and the walking cane, although it does appear when he's playing the tramp, once again, the character usually is considered to have been retired in modern times, in 1936, and Chaplin doesn't consider this a Little Tramp film.
Well, that's nice of him, but I'm going to have to say he's wrong.
Yeah. The barber scenes, where he's playing the barber as opposed to Hinkle, were mostly shot in the slower speed used for silent films, 16 frames per second, made possible by the fact that Charles Chaplin gave the character less dialogue than Hinkle, who was shot in the standard speed for sound film. Supposedly, when they were filming the scene where the artillery shell falls out of the super gun for the first time at the very beginning.
Big Bertha.
Charlie Chaplin's young son, Sidney, was on site and busted out laughing so loud he ruined the take. Originally, Chaplin wanted the role of the barber to be a paper hanger, but that's a little too on the nose.
Oh.
And as originally written, the final speech where the barber is still masquerading as Hinkle, calling for peace through appeasement. As the news reports came in from Europe, he rewrote it as a call for peace and liberty for all. Some critics, especially the columnist, not the TV host, Ed Sullivan, claimed the speech was pure communist propaganda. Nice, huh?
Communist? Because
all people working together and telling the soldiers to rise up again. I don't know.
I guess I can sort of vaguely, if I squint and fart at the same time, see that point.
Yes, and if you shut down 90% of your brain, yeah.
Mm. Oh, that
there's a ton. There's a ton of other stuff, but I think that's plenty. You said you had something.
Yeah, just you talked about how Roosevelt was saying make the movie. As it turns out, That speech, while it didn't win a lot of favor for Chaplin, it was responsible for his being asked to read it over the radio during Roosevelt's 1941 inauguration. And a couple, so that was, I think it was actually read a number of different places. He was asked to redo that many times. And it's, for what it, we'll get to whether it works or not in the film, it is a very obviously impassioned plea. And at the very least, I think that part is worth listening to, because sadly, it didn't have, let's see how to put this, any impact at all.
Not really.
On humanity. But yeah, so you should tell us the story.
I should. Achtung! In the fictional country of Tomania, a goofy Jewish barber is injured at the close of World War I and spends the next decade or so off screen while an insane and totally fictional dictator, Adenoid Hinkle, no doubt a relative of Mr. Hilter, rises to power. Returning to his home in the Jewish ghetto, famous city, the barber finds the world has changed and his people are oppressed. Help! Help! I'm being oppressed!
Ooh, it's a dead giveaway.
This does not stop him from falling in love with the beautiful laundress next door, who he introduces to the world of shampoo. Many fascist hijinks ensue. In the end, the barber is mistaken for the dictator, no doubt having something to do with the fact that both characters are played by Charlie Chaplin, and instead of exhorting Tomania's soldiers to war, he makes an impassioned speech for love and peace and his ship and Miramani. I mean, it's very touching, and people are happy, even if we don't really see how any of this resolves. The end. The film.
So this is one of those films, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've heard of Chaplin, probably City Lights, The Kid are right up
Modern
there.
Modern Times.
Modern Times is probably his really big ones. And then The Great Dictator, I think, is known, for nothing else visually, you've seen images of him.
Maybe. As,
yeah.
This isn't the one people see. I've never seen this movie, ever.
Me neither.
I knew about it. Everyone knew about it. The most I knew about it was from our episode on the movie Chaplin. See our episode on the movie Chaplin.
Yeah.
Where we see him recreate a couple of those scenes. We see Robert Downey Jr. do them. And I have to say, having seen this, Downey does a really good job.
Yeah. I mean, Downey is a really good actor. I'm trying to remember. Is that his comeback film, or is that when he was at his worst? I can't remember.
No, that was around his turnaround point.
Okay.
That was right before Iron Man, I think.
Okay. And interestingly, so Chaplin was ridiculously productive. If you look at his film history from right around 1914, he's making multiple films a year. Like his list for 1914 is like 21 films he made.
In a year.
And then in 1915, he didn't make quite as many. He made, I'd guess about 10, and then 16, then 18. And then
he wrote like almost 90 films, and he acted in over 90 films.
Yeah, and he was very productive. He starts skipping a couple of years, starting around 1923. He skipped a couple of years between Woman of Paris and Gold Rush, which is another biggie. And then a few years between The Gold Rush and The Circus, and then City Lights, and then 5 years between City Lights and Modern Times, and then another 4 years before this. So now, to be fair, he wasn't old when he made this, but he's already built up quite a stack of film. And this, I guess, is his first sound film. So you hadn't seen it. You've seen Charlie Chaplin films before, though, right?
Oh, God, yes. Ever since I was a kid.
So how weird was it for you when he starts talking?
It's pretty weird. Yeah. I mean, especially when he used to swear up and down. And I think this is why he says this isn't a Little Tramp movie. He swore the Little Tramp would never speak. He got in all sorts of trouble. The studios, Max Sennett, all of them begging him, you got to have the Tramp speak now that we're doing sound. And he was like, no, I won't do it. It completely destroys the character. And he tries to get around that, I guess, by, you know, this isn't the Tramp. This is the barber.
But dressed up like him, wearing the same makeup and the same costume,
exactly the same kind of body movements. Everything is pretty much the same.
Yeah,
the facial expressions, makeup. Yeah.
Well, let's take that for a second. So Chaplin himself said the Little Tramp character wouldn't work if he talked.
Yeah.
Do you think that's true?
You know, I kind of do.
Yeah.
I'm glad that he gives the barber so little dialogue, because when he does, it sounds wrong. When he's doing Hinkle, it's great. It's when he's doing Hinkle, it works with all the screaming and the blustering and the bombastic stuff.
It just made me hungry.
The fake bugs. You know, I got to say, did you watch that and think, I'm beginning to see where the Warner Brothers got their sort of take on animated Hitler when they would do the World War II propaganda cartoons?
I have three different notes from watching this film that have Bugs Bunny in them.
One of them's the shaving scene, isn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah. So
that's what I wrote down too.
I'm going to agree too. I think the little tramp and Charles Chaplin, because that's what it says.
Yeah.
His aesthetic, at least up till this point, is rooted deeply in silent film. And that's pantomime and, I want to say, dance. Let's face it. He's a very dancer-like film creator.
He's incredibly graceful, too.
Yeah.
In that legendary sequence, which is probably, if any of you have seen clips, this is the one you've seen, where Hinkle is dancing with a globe. It's a huge balloon that's painted to look like the world. And he's dancing with it. And it's a friggin' ballet.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I mean, it's a throwaway, but he goes from a standing start and jumps up onto his desk. That's not assisted. He did that in one move.
The only other person I've seen do that was, let me think. Yeah, Felix Unger in an episode of The Odd Couple.
Yeah, I know which one you mean. That's the coffee table. But this was
it was Oscar's desk.
It was a desk? Oh, yeah. All right.
He did. Okay. Yeah. It's not easy, though. And of course, Oscar can't do it, which.
Yeah.
No, so, I don't think it works either. I think I almost wish he hadn't even tried to do The Little Tramp, although I can see why he felt he needed to, because the whole point was, well, people keep telling me I look like Hitler, so.
Yeah.
Sorry, Hinkle. Hinkle. Marlon Hinkle. We usually go through the actors.
Mm-hmm.
I guess we can.
Sure. Yeah, let's do it. Yeah. Well, Chaplin's the obvious one. I think we've kind of already talked about him.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry. I know this is very dated and all. He's funny as hell in this.
Okay.
Just the body language, the facial expressions, the physical humor.
Okay.
Nowadays, we look at it and think of it as cliche, but he's the one who built the cliche.
Yeah.
You don't think so?
I really felt like his silent era shtick felt old and funny and unfunny. I felt like it had been taken past the point that it worked. And honestly, sound might have had something to do with that. I don't know. I think he's perfectly fine being Charlie Chaplin. I don't think this is a performance that I would make stand out.
Okay. What about Paulette Goddard, who was at the time she had just finished being his wife?
Oops. Oh, well, she was one of many. They could make a baseball team out of the people that were no longer Mrs. Charles Chaplin.
Yeah, no, they were married in secret in 1936, and they split up in 1940.
She's fine.
Yeah.
I hate to say this, but that's pretty much going to be my grade for most of the other people. Eh? They're fine.
Okay.
I don't think this is an actor's film.
No, not really.
I think this is a Charles Chaplin film where really the only part that really counts is him. And yes, there are people there. Obviously, the guy playing Schultz is very upstanding, but it just kept striking me as weird how many of the quote-unquote German characters had American accents.
English. I mean, Reginald Gardner, who plays Schultz, I thought he was fine, but it always felt like he was... Have you wandered in from a different movie?
Yeah, like when he first basically falls into Schultz's plane, I thought he had accidentally fallen into an enemy plane, and this guy was British.
I thought he was an Englishman.
Because he is.
Reginald Gardner is.
Yeah,
and, you know,
that was
Jack
weird.
Jack Oakey as Napoloni, he's fine, he's funny. I mean, he's trying to be a cartoon.
Yeah, and he was.
He does, he pulls it off. And, you know, the Henry Daniell as, you know, garbage.
Or it garbage.
It's actually garbage.
Yeah.
But it's clearly garbage. It's clearly he's good.
You are my garbage. Gar being a type of fish, so therefore you are my female fish, I guess.
Uh-huh. Fine. Billy Gilbert as,
Herring.
As herring.
Yeah.
Yeah, Madam. Everyone else is fine.
Yeah, there's no real... I didn't feel like there was any real standouts amongst the rest of the cast.
I mean, I do think Oki is having a lot of fun, and that comes across when he's playing the Mussolini clone.
Napoloni?
Yeah.
Yeah, the dictator of bacteria. Get it? Well, Tomania bacteria.
Yeah, I'm sorry, the Marx brothers do it better with Fredonia and Sylvania.
All right, I'm going to put this right out there since you brought it up. One of my notes was, I really wish I had been watching a Marx brother film.
In terms of funny, that Duck Soup, I think, is a funnier movie.
Yeah.
Now, this movie, I got to say, for 1940, I'd say we're done talking about the cast.
Yeah, they're fine.
The scale that this movie is shot on surprised me, especially the opening where you've got, like, where the hell they get the tanks from?
Yeah, except if I don't know if you noticed this, and this actually feeds very well into the last poll question, which I didn't expect it to do. How many shots were shot in front of a rear projection? Because I'm going to go with most of them.
A lot of them were. Any with okay, the vehicles.
Another film we might talk about later in this show will also have been shot in front of a lot of background, especially when actors are supposed to be walking, and it's like, So, yeah, there's some, and the thing is, I'm sitting there looking at this, though, and I can't help but going, that's California. Yeah, that's California. 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 So, yeah, I mean, he spent a lot of money on it, but one of the big problems with Chaplin, and then I saw a documentary about, I don't think it was Ken Burns, but it was done in the 80s around the time when he was starting to become a thing. There were sometimes over 1,000 takes on a given gag in a single film. So, like, it's one shot, one scene, and there were like take 1,041 click.
Oh my
That's where a lot of his money was spent, was redoing and redoing, rewriting, restaging.
I wondered how he spent over $2 million on this. That's 1940, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, well, and where did he get I know where he got the money because of all his other films. I think he left. When he died, I read that he left his wife, Una, because that was her name. Was it Oprah? Una? Oprah?
Oprah?
Una? Una? Oprah? Yeah. That's a deeper. I think he left her $30 million. So after everything, and this is 1970.
The late 70s, I think.
Yeah. So that's not a, that's a much bigger chunk than $30 million is now. $30 million now is people going, that's not big enough for me to buy a lottery ticket. As sad as that is, but yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that's a chunk of it's probably because I'm betting because it started production as early as maybe 37. He was probably writing, rewriting. But, you know, like you said, tanks and big giant gun props and stuff like that. However, once they get to the ghetto, it's like, oh, yeah, I've been here before.
Yep. They're very clearly on a back lot.
I did think that Chaplin's makeup seemed a little thicker than usual. Like, he was extra pale as the not tramp character, and I thought that was because he stood out from the other characters, I thought. But
well, I think he is supposed to. I mean, he's almost like in mime white face as the tramp, and I think that's clearer as they'd gotten more sophisticated in the makeup arts. And also, this was a restored print, which is what I assume you saw.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's way more obvious that, his makeup is a lot paler than everyone else's.
Well, it's our old friends at the Criterion Collection, right? Who,
yep,
they really know how to treat a film. And I don't think this film ever looked this good when it was originally out in 1940. I bet it never, like, there's not a single scratch in it. It's absolutely gorgeous.
No, it's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
So What points besides, so the dance sequence with the globe and that's a standout. Yeah. I think that is considered one of his classics. It feels like it's supposed to be one of his classic bits. What other scenes to you really stood out?
Well, the guy when he's shaving the guy to Hungarian Rhapsody number 5.
Because
all I could think of was the Rabbit of Seville.
Right, which of course isn't using that same piece. Well, that piece of music will show up in many Bugs Bunny cartoons, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, it's public domain. It doesn't cost anything.
Yeah. My note for that, though, was the shaving scene was done better by Bugs Bunny.
Well, when you're a cartoon, you can do more.
Yeah, I guess. And I, to be fair, part of that might be because I'm more familiar with Bugs Bunny. I've seen that cartoon many times. I, thanks to Bugs Bunny, I know a good deal of the plot and or music of operas, much to my mother's disdain. So I, that might be a bias on my part, but I was like, ah, I've seen it done better by Bugs Bunny. And probably much later. But yeah, what other scenes stood out for you?
Well, one of the other sort of cartoon echoes were when Herring keeps bringing in these inventions for his leader, like that parachute hat and the perfect bulletproof. All I can, I, my note was, I think Herring is working for the Acme Corporation.
I just thought, because of course,
none of them work.
Well, I mean, we don't get to see the parachute hat, which honestly really bothered me. I was like, if he's going to make a parachute hat, I want to see what happens. I don't need to see him hit the ground because we know that's where he's going. But I want to see him jump in it to pop out and then him fall. But, you know, we don't.
I also kind of, I remember the sequence where it's sort of a running gag where Hinkle stalks out of his office, goes into another room, and there's one guy there painting his portrait and one guy doing a sculpture of him. And he stands, poses, and they try to do as much as they can in like 10 seconds. And he stomps out. And they just look away. They'll throw their tools down in disgust.
Well, it's funny because when they first shows up into the room, they look a little exasperated. And then they scramble to get back to where they were. And at first I thought they were annoyed that he was there. And then I realized, no, they're annoyed that they get 10 seconds to continue work on their stuff. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. One of the scenes that I thought stands out just because I found it annoying was Napoloni's entrance on the train. And they keep doing the gag where they're rolling out the red carpet and then the train moves and they have to pick up the carpet, move it there, and the train moves back. They do that like four times. And by the fourth time, I'm like, Charles, we get it. Okay, you only had to do that like once.
Yeah, that was one of those rear projection scenes where the train's not exactly in focus, but
yeah.
You do what you can. Yeah. Any other scenes that stood out for you?
Well, I mean, there's the trial by pudding when they're doing the sort of king of the bean thing, trying to figure who's going to go and try to blow up the dictator's palace because they put a coin in one of the puddings.
Well, and the funniest part about that is it turns out that would actually be a real plot where a German officer does in fact try to go in and blow up.
That was Operation Valkyrie, yeah.
Yeah. So, I think, wasn't that Tom Cruise who tried to do that? I think it was.
Yes. Yes, it was. But unfortunately, he was too short to slip the bomb onto the top shelf. Sorry, Mr. Cruise. I'm sorry. That was
You are
mean.
Not at all. So,
well, he might come up and punch me in the knee. I don't know.
Wow, we're going to get banned by the Scientologists. Eat me, Xenu.
L. So, Ron Hubbard is a hack. Yes.
Was. He's dead. Or is
that's
he?
What they want you to think.
Or is it? Yeah, the end.
Yes, he is.
So there's a real mix of tone in this film. Would you agree?
Yes, very much so.
How did you feel? Well, go ahead.
I mean, you're dealing with, especially looking at it from modern perspective, where we know what was going on in the Jewish ghettos, whereas in America, that was still kind of just rumored, and people were dismissing it, saying, oh, I'm sure that's just propaganda. But they go from, you know, harassment and violence of the Jews to slapstick, and it's kind of jarring. But some of it, I got to say, some of it makes it pretty effective. There's moments of real fear when the stormtroopers, who are sometimes just played off as comic figures, then they suddenly are figures of terror. And when they're like, when he is being surrounded by them, that's genuinely intimidating. You know, when he's walking down the street and, like 12 of them come around a corner, and he turns around and there's another dozen there and another dozen there. It's like, oh, geez, that's actually kind of frightening. And honestly, it's kind of, it affects the mood kind of badly, I think. It's uneven. What about you?
I agree. Especially when it comes to violence against the main female character there, who's Anna or whatever her name was.
Hannah.
It just felt too close to home and too realistic. Whether Chaplin had any knowledge of the sorts of things that were actually going on or not, he certainly seemed to.
No one's sure. Sorry to interrupt, but there's questions about that. He kept saying, I had no idea how terrible these people really were. And other people are saying, yeah, he knew. He had gotten reports, you know, the English, he had contacts in England. They were telling him and what was going on. And that just made him more, you know, he really wanted to just trash these people.
Yeah. I thought it really didn't work. I really felt that when he, and to be fair, by modern standards, his violence is nowhere near, I mean, this wouldn't even rate a PG. This would be like G13, and then that's only for sort of subject matter, right? Because there's nothing there. Never mind PG. But it just, like, it made me feel like we're not supposed to laugh. I mean, is Charlie Chaplin, what is his goal? Is his goal to entertain us, or is his goal to make us aware of something that's going on? And I don't think that those two things necessarily work here. And partly because when I would see, you know, I'd be laughing, or when I'm supposed to be laughing at something, then a moment later I see this horrible violence and this injustice, I felt guilty for laughing or wanting to laugh, because it's like, we shouldn't laugh at this subject. It's really deadly serious. Well, then why are you making jokes? I couldn't figure out what his... It almost felt like his goal changed while making the film. And the scenes that were more serious got more and more serious towards the end, till we get to that ending point where you're like, how is he going to wrap this up? It's 1940. We're 5 years before this stuff finishes, and even he has no idea how that's going to go.
No, but as I said before... There, as he learned more about it, because, you know, he spent 3 years making this movie, he changed. He started to change things. I mean, the original ending was a lot goofier.
Yeah,
and I will talk. I do want to talk about the ending at some point, but
yeah,
it, the way the tone shifts is strange. It is entirely possible to entertain and make someone, people aware of a situation.
Mm-hmm.
I just, we'll have to think about, did he succeed in that with this?
It's funny, there's an interesting episode of MASH that actually works very well in this. So there's a point where somebody has gotten Colonel, what's his name, and they said, hey, we need to make basically a propaganda film showing how our wonderful doctors are doing so well and everyone's heroic and patriotic here in Korea, i.e. Vietnam. So a film crew shows up to make this kind of pro-war film and how things are so working so well, and the doctors are all Yankee Doodle Dandy and all that sort of thing. I'm sorry, Yankee Doodle Doctor.
Right.
And Hawkeye, of course, gets hold of the thing and said, basically he sabotages the project and ends up being able to direct it. And what he does is he takes the script and Frank's narration, which is very straight, and he does Marx Brothers stuff to it. He makes fun of it and he makes you laugh through the whole thing until the end. And at the end, he goes, yeah, that's all fun, but this is what's really going on. And I thought that that worked really well, because he gives you your moment and then says, just so you know, as opposed to going back and forth, where you sort of feel a little bit off balance, I think, as an audience member, not knowing, can I laugh again or not? Then, of course, we get to the end. Do you want to get to the ending? Might as well.
Yeah. Yeah, by the way, I do want
to... The ending of the film, not the show.
Yeah. The ending of the film, where basically it becomes a five-minute monologue, which I got to say right now, it's beautiful. The prose is wonderful, and the sentiments expressed are wonderful about peace and brotherhood and being kind and saying the most important thing people can do is help, not rule. It's just, it completely changes the tone of the end of the film.
Well, he's not, what character is he at that point?
That's the thing. He's supposed to be the barber who has been mistaken for Hinkle.
Yeah. At the very end, you get Prince of the Pauper, and it's like, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
But the thing is, when he's talking, I don't hear the barber. The barber hasn't been this eloquent. The barber barely says more than one sentence at a time, and suddenly he becomes this master orator. It's very clear this is Chaplin. This is Charles Chaplin talking.
Right.
This is not either of the characters he's playing.
I thought it was so out of joint with the rest of the movie as to be not even of the movie.
It really is like, okay, movie's over. Now I'm just going to... This is me talking to the audience. Because he's looking straight into the camera.
Yeah.
At least at the end he is, yeah.
And here's the thing, no matter what you think of Chaplin or his films, I recommend watching that speech because, sadly, yeah, it's still really appropriate today. And he is so impassioned and, as you said, so eloquent. It's a very important speech. I just don't think it belongs in this movie.
I don't know where else he would have put it, though. But,
well, maybe if he'd ended the film narratively in some way, even if it was funny, and then, I just would like to take a moment to talk to you about blah, something else separately. But it does, as if looking at this as a film, I don't think that ending works within the structure of this film. Flavor is totally different.
In a film where 10 minutes before we had someone getting hit in the face with a plate of spaghetti.
Yeah.
This is very jarring, and I think it loses some of its effectiveness. When taken by itself, it's incredibly powerful and incredibly moving. But, yeah, in the context of the movie, it kind of is confusing.
Mm. And I bet it made a lot of people angry because they were there to be entertained, and suddenly there's this. And so it might actually have diluted his point in some way.
I wonder.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to get to before our conclusion? Because I think there's going to be a surprise.
No, I think I'm good. The finish.
So, Max.
Yeah.
You'd never seen The Great Dictator before
A couple of scenes. Yeah.
I'm both surprised and not surprised you haven't seen it. I know you're a bigger cinephile than I am, but a lot of us don't tend to venture into silent films because it's a bit more work. And quite honestly, I don't know about your attention span, but mine tends to wander. And if I haven't got anybody talking or anything, yeah. So
I enjoy silent films. I've seen a lot of them, and sometimes they really work. You got to remember, considering how many of them they were churning out, there are a lot of duds too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just like today.
Yeah.
Well, so what did you think?
I'm really glad I saw it. Historically, this is a really important film. I get that. I think some of it still makes me laugh. I laughed out loud at a bunch of points. I love the flying upside down sequence. It's so cleverly done. I like the physical comedy. The problem is this isn't a comedy, or it doesn't end as a comedy. I think it's too I think the tone is very uneven. If someone said, recommend me a Chaplin film, I would say, go watch Modern Times or The Gold Rush. And if you really want to be a completist, watch this. I think it's an important film. I think it's an impressive film. I'm just kind of mixed. It's a mixed bag for me. How about you?
Well, I used words like drag, unfunny, boring, dull.
Oh, dear.
I didn't laugh once. I didn't find any of this film funny. And one of my notes is, if not for our show, I wouldn't have finished watching it. It's not that it's bad. It feels like something that would have been funny 20 years before it was made. So by 1940, I'm looking at other films and I think Multisalkin comes out, the same year or the year before, or year after, something like that?
Right around then, yeah.
And I'm way more entertained by that. I've watched Multisalkin many times. And it's not that it's a comedy. In a way, you can't compare them. But on the other hand, I can sit there and go, that film is not uneven. Sure, we never know who killed the guy, but, you know, whatever, the author doesn't know himself, so who cares?
Yeah.
It felt so much of the little tramp stuff, which wasn't the little tramp stuff, just felt like he was fighting to be relevant. And it didn't, to me, it didn't work. The balloon dance sequence, sure. I see that as I watched this going, oh, this is meant to be a classic Chaplin bit, which it is. And it is very nicely done, but it's also not relevant to anything. He's just doing it to do it. In fact, this didn't feel much like a narrative. It felt like a bunch of gags stitched together with the weird part about how the two characters happen to look alike, which doesn't even pay off until the end. And when it does, I had to pull a Grunkle Stan and go, oh, come on!
I did have to say that surprised me a little. I kept waiting for that to be a thing where someone would say, my God, he looks just like the leader. And no one does until literally the last 10 minutes.
Well, and also the whole reasoning behind it. Oh, for some reason, the Fooey, because it's not the Fuhrer, it's the Fooey.
Right.
has gone off duck hunting by himself. with no guards, nobody else around for reasons nobody explains. He just does that. And the only reason he does that is so he can fall out of his boat and come up on shore and people arrest him, not for some reason, not recognizing him. So sure, whatever. I don't think it worked. I really don't. And sadly, I was literally fighting off sleep at points, trying not to fall asleep. Wow. But when he got to that final speech, I woke up because that was, you know, you could feel the passion in that. It's
very powerful.
Yeah. So but here's the big question. This was nominated for, was Outstanding Production. It wasn't Best Picture because that's what they called it. This did not win Outstanding Production that year. Another film did.
Yep. That was Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm.
No, there's no farm.
Okay. No. It was the Alfred Hitchcock directed and David O. Selznick produced.
Famous Irish Jew.
Famous Irish Jew. David O. Selznick.
Oh, he's out in the patio night. Yeah.
We're canceled.
Hey, I'm Irish. I can say stuff like that. Italian and Norwegian and a lot of other things. Mm-hmm. So had you seen Rebecca or did you watch it for the show?
I had seen it. I watched part of it for the show just to remind myself. This is a Hitchcock movie. This is based on a Du Maurier novel. Yeah. Mm. And it's starring, you know, Larry Joan Olivier and Sir Lawrence freaking Olivier.
Yes.
And Nigel Bruce. I was happy to see him.
Bumbling.
The bumbling upsets Holmes no end.
Oh, so simple a child could figure it out.
Not your child, Watson.
My favorite Sherlock Holmes line ever. It won.
It did.
Should it have won over The Great Dictator?
Honestly, kinda. Yeah. I mean, it hangs together better as a movie. The cinematography is gorgeous, although there's a lot of walking in front of rear projection in that, too. Yeah.
Also, the opening shot when they're coming up to the house, all I could think of was, Mandalay, Mandalay, Mandalay. It's only a model. Shh.
a little bit of that. But Joan Fontaine's wonderful, and the performances are very good.
Larry is...
Lawrence
dashing. He's pretty dashing, don't you think?
He is. He's very good looking in this. He's very elegant.
And very British.
So British. The man, if he was any more British, he would be a crumpet. It's amazing. Yeah.
Also, during the whole film, all I could think of was, Tom Stewart killed me.
You're alone in that.
It is very upstairs, downstairs, which is something that we Americans absolutely adore. You know, look at Downton Abbey, upstairs, downstairs, Gosford Park, which is a film I really, really like. I will say, though, I was surprised when you suggested Great Dictator and its chaplain. It's like, oh, yeah, hour and a quarter. 2 hours and 5 minutes.
But it is surprisingly long, especially for that era.
Hitchcock, early Hitchcock, no problem. 2 hours and 16 minutes.
Yeah.
And I gotta say, while the film is interesting, languid is a term I would use if I was being kind.
It is not fast-paced.
No.
It's very, what do they call it, atmospheric.
Sure. Yeah,
a lot of lingering shots, a lot of waiting for things to happen.
That don't.
Yeah. What still gets me is the movie that was also up that year, that was The Philadelphia Story.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, that should have beaten it.
Well, but never mind.
It was a comedy.
Never mind the, oh dear gods, Grapes of Wrath was up that year too. Which
that too.
Henry Fonda and a whole bunch of other people. So I would vote for Rebecca over Great Dictator for sure. But could it use some editing. There were some cool twists in there. There was one that it's like, it's going to be this. And it was like, okay, there's that. Oh, there's another one. So that was actually kind of nice. And there was a couple of shots. It's like, oh, that's totally Hitchcock. Totally Hitchcock. And it's early Hitchcock, so... Yeah, I'm going to say that in this particular case, I would have voted for Rebecca, too. But one of the things I will say I found interesting about our series is that the films we picked, I would say both of us probably going in were like, oh, yeah, this film should have won. And I want to say it's a mixed bag. I want to say it's probably close to half and half. We were like, you know what?
Yeah. Like,
I didn't vote for Citizen Kane for Best Picture. You did.
But I did.
Yeah. I was like, you know what? I think I'm fine with what it was. And Wizard of Oz were also both Yeah, I think we'd pick Wizard of Oz, but which is a better film, which is more has more impact.
This one's more fun, but...
Yeah. But we definitely both agreed with Spade 2001, so, and Singing in the Rain, really. And it wasn't even nominated. So I think it was actually a pretty interesting series. Hopefully our listeners
So. Hope you guys liked it.
But you know what else is interesting? The poll question. What? Would you go over that for us, please?
I will, but only because my beloved leader demands it.
I'm your leader?
Hail, Bumpy!
It's always the
Do pony. You watch any of the major movie awards shows? The Oscars, the Golden Globes, the BAFTAs, the SAG Awards? And if not, do you like intentionally like I don't watch them for a reason, or you just you don't get around to it? And you can tell us by emailing us at us@maxmikemovies.com, or you can go to our website maxmikemovies.com and leave a comment. You can also leave comments about tell us how spectacularly handsome we are, even though you don't know what we look like, or tell us, even give us ideas for other series, or tell us if you agree or we were way off base on something. And you can also find us on Facing the Books.
Facebook, at, Max, Facebook, Facebook!
Max Mike Movies.
Hate you. Fired!
And we are on many, many of the podcast apps, if not all. Yeah. But this does indeed bring to an end our series. Didn't win.
Thank you, Murray.
And we have a new series starting up next week, which is actually pretty timely, as it is a tribute.
I wrote an opening.
A tribute, which Mike will now read. Thank
you. Well, Max, we're starting a new series next week.
We are?
We are.
Oh, my God.
Not like I didn't tell you, but okay. There's a certain director who has probably had more influence over Hollywood than any other single director out there. He's given more people their first chance than anyone else I can think of in the last 10 seconds, has directed over 50 films himself, and produced nearly 500.
500.
Sadly, we lost him recently, but what better way to salute him than with his own series, Be Like the Core Man.
Yes. Live like the Core Man.
Love like the Core Man. Yes, it's Roger Corman. And yes, I know I'm paraphrasing Robot Monster, which was directed by Phil Tucker. And no, I didn't have to look that up. And yes, I am deeply ashamed of that fact.
As you should be.
We're going to be looking at the best and worst of what the Core Man had to offer. And what movie are we going to start with, you might ask? That's your
What cue. Movie are we going to start with?
Well, I can't think of a better way to usher in this new series than one of the big old sweet juicy House of Usher. Yes, one of quite a few Edgar Allan Poe stories adapted by the Core Man will be our first up in our new series. So join us next week when we'll be burning down the house of Usher, that is.
This has been a co-production of The Voice of Max and The Movie Wrench.